Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Megan Cloherty, joined by co-producers Anna Myers, Julie O'Donohue, and Michael O'Connell. And today we have Rick Klein with us. Rick is political director at ABC News. He is currently senior Washington editor for World News Tonight with Diane Sawyer. He also co-hosts Top Line, a political webcast that's daily, isn't it?
Weekly now, but we'll go back to daily.
We'll go back to that. It's weekly. And he is a regular guest on Fox News and NPR. Graduate of Princeton, Rick spent his early career at the Dallas Morning News and the Boston Globe. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Yep, and you just came from ABC. You're doing a show.
Yeah, this week we just did the This Week roundtable. Actually, I made an appearance on that roundtable, so that was fun.
Well, good. You made an appearance on us.
What was the topic of conversation?
A little bit about the Obama health care law and the ramifications of that delay. Big story this week. Immigration, which of course is consuming Washington for much of the summer. And then just wrapping this President Obama's trip to Africa and that unique joint appearance with President Bush over in Tanzania.
So let's start with, and we're going to backtrack big time here. Let's start with like how your career got started. You graduated with a degree in politics. Did you always know this was kind of where you wanted to be in Washington covering this?
Yes. I mean, I joke about this, but you know, I remember watching George Will like it was a spectator sport on the This Week roundtable, you know, in junior high school. I always knew I wanted to do political journalism. At an earlier age than that, I was just interested in politics and just that kid that was coloring electoral college maps when Michael Dukakis was getting blown out. And so wow. I knew I wanted something to do with politics. And as time went by, political journalism seemed like a more attractive option. It kind of, for me, just converged a lot of my different interests, politics being one, of course, also sports and the excitement and the competition of politics. Yeah. and media, broadcasting, as well as print. I was editor-in-chief of my college newspaper, the Daily Princetonian. I also worked at the college radio station and broadcast basketball games and football games and baseball games and those sort of things. So it just fit at the right nexus of things for me.
Or like George Will, do you have a weird poetic love for baseball?
I do, as a matter of fact. and I'll also admit to having only – I have a lot of signed baseballs, but only one in my office, and it's from George Will. I got it in college when he came to speak there. So, but yes, I'm a Yankees fan, unapologetically so. Also adopted the Nationals as a team since living in Washington. So they're my National League team. Okay.
So you started in TV, but then you went to print? Kind of tell us
no,
about –
No, actually, I started as a print reporter entirely. I did. Okay. I did some broadcasting in college, but I went into print reporting exclusively at the Dallas Morning News. And this was the late 90s. The job market was pretty good, and people were getting hired out of internships, that sort of thing. So I got an internship in Dallas after I graduated college and drove from New York halfway across the country to Dallas and set up shop there and just did metro reporting, cops and courts type stuff. I had some exposure to TV then because the local ABC affiliate, actually, WFAA, had joined with the Dallas Morning News. They have the same ownership group, BLO, and started something called TXEN, Texas Cable News, which is probably one of the earlier regional cable outlets. So they were desperate for content early on, and they would have Dallas Morning News reporters on to talk about their stories. Huh. So you just go to a little newsroom flash cam, which are now ubiquitous. Every newsroom has them, but there weren't many in 1998, 1999 that had them like that. So that was a little bit of ahead of its time. But then I was a print reporter. I got a job at the Boston Globe in late 2000, covered State House, City Hall stuff, came to Washington to cover the Bush campaign for the Globe, and did some TV around the edges, but it was never my primary gig. And it actually wasn't my primary gig when I got hired at ABC in 2007. I didn't really feel like I was working in television for the first few years because I was writing for the website. It was like I was a print reporter that just happened to be at a place that made a lot of television. So I did some TV, again, around the edges. I've always done cable hits, but I've kind of transitioned more toward the TV thing, but I still have a lot of the writing and everything else that goes involved in journalism, you name it.
We were talking when Rick came in about The Note, which really has kind of started not small, I don't know, I don't want to say small, but it really has become this huge thing where there's multiple writers, and now it's sort of generally regarded as a source every morning for a lot of politicos in D.C. Tell us about, you know, you're taking over that in 2007 and yeah, just what it's about generally.
Yeah, I think there's a lesson there, sort of a microcosm for how journalism evolves, is how a product like that is created in the first place and then evolves. It started actually as an internal newsletter that one of my predecessors as political director, Mark Halperin, started at ABC News. And he would just put this thing together every morning, kind of a roundup of political stories with his take. And people looked at it and said, hey, this is pretty good. Maybe we should do something with it. So they just started putting it on the website. And it grew an audience and sponsorships and money followed it, but lots of clicks, and it certainly grew in influence. And by the time I took it over in 2007, it was I think the premier kind of morning tip sheet. It started out as the only one, and then since then NBC started doing a very similar one, CNN, Washington Post, Politico. There were a lot of folks who kind of entered that space, and I think we've evolved over time. In part because of that. I mean, largely because of that. And I think the journalism has changed so fast, so much in the last 10, 15 years that you can't keep a product static and expect that the audience is going to follow, whether that's World News with Diane Sawyer or an online political tip sheet or a podcast. I mean, everything has to change with the audience and changing viewing and reading habits.
And it's funny, too. Like when you read it, it's broken up in different ways. So you can say, you know, what's buzzworthy or whatever. It's not just like the five things you need to know.
Right.
And there's opinion in there, too, which I think is sort of different.
Yeah, I think one of the things we're trying to get at a little bit is the same kind of dynamic of a political roundtable where people come at it with a point of view and they argue a little bit. And that to me is the best. Again, getting back to the sports metaphor, which you can take too far and you can get critiqued for. But, I think politics is about the game of it, the process of it, the argument of it. It's not about there's no end goal that we're going to be done with politics because we've got all the perfect laws and the perfect system in place. It is the process. It is getting there. Mm-hmm. And you have to relish it. And I think our readers and our viewers do relish the figures, the issues, the policy and the players. It's all part of that in this town that we call home.
Do you sometimes feel, I mean, you're in D.C., do you sometimes feel you're only, like, talking to people in D.C., or do you...
The bubble.
Feel, yeah. Do you feel that there's as much intensity beyond the Beltway as you're sort of experiencing?
I think there's layers of an audience for any outlet, you name it, and I think there's a kind of inner layer of true insiders, and you know, they for whom this is an important piece of work for, you know, every day, and everything we do is viewed by them and seen by them, read by them on that level. I think you have a slightly larger, definitely larger, kind of scattered universe of, you know, real junkies, people like, you know, how people who are really into weather watch the Weather Channel all day, mm-hmm. whether there's extreme weather or not. Like we have a political junkies who are watching what we're doing, and you know, they'd watch ESPN if they're into sports as much. So that's a universe. And then the you know, significantly larger universe, which is always the challenge, is to reach people who maybe they don't have a disdain for politics because they really should go elsewhere if they have a true hatred of it. But, you know, casual interest in it, you know, ramps up around election time. We see our numbers jump through the roof around the time of an election and then drop down again. People engage as they feel, as they see fit. And so to get those, you know, very much more casual viewers and readers, I think is always the challenge. We know we're going to have the core of the insiders and the junkies, but to get beyond that. And what we try to do at ABC News is to very much get beyond that. Because let's be honest, like the kind of numbers that a network counts in aren't going to be influenced by the insider group. You know, that, you know, if another 10,000 insiders, even, which is a huge number of insiders, are watching, that's not going to change the ratings. That's not going to change the financing of a website. But, you know, hundreds of thousands, now you're talking. And that's I think what we do and we try to do in terms of how we communicate these things is to stay out of the real weedsy policy stuff, the, you know, senators you've never heard of, that kind of thing, just people and issues that have real impact and to make it relatable.
Do you think so? As I mentioned in the intro, Rick is oversees the content for World News Tonight out of Washington. And is it hard to stay on top of the politics thing? Because obviously that's like your bread and butter for most of the day. And then it's, you know, that World News comes on at 6:30. So at like, what, 4:30, everything just kind of goes crazy. And I mean, does it pull you away at all, or do you have trouble balancing that, or is it, you know, all planning?
Well, we have talented producers like your dad, Jack Clardy.
Yeah, my dad works there.
Full disclosure. But actually, he does something that is not politics at all, which is, you know, part of Washington with the Justice Department and you know, all the criminal justice world of Washington. There's another level of Washington. It does to some degree, but it also challenges us to think broadly about things because you have that very small window of time. You know, World News with Diane Sawyer is 22 minutes. And in that 22 minutes, they've got to do the weather story. They've got to do some health news, or not got to, but often, you know, mm-hmm. some foreign news is often in there. Something heartwarming, something cute, something fun. There's a lot that's competing for that 22 minutes of time. So I could fill it with politics every night, but that's not. they don't let me do that very often.
What?
Maybe on election day or election eve, but that's about it. Mostly, you know, we'll have one spot, maybe two, that talks about politics that really gets into it. So you have to make the most of that opportunity, make the most of that of the medium, and to use what it is. Is to have that 22 minutes of precious television time. So it forces us, no matter where you work at ABC, it forces you to think about, you know, very deeply about every second of television and what works for the medium that we're producing for.
And that audience, right?
I mean, definitely.
Where does digital fit into this? Well, let me ask you that in two parts. First, when did you were on a, print to a broadcast track. At what point did you suddenly realize what's going on here? There's this digital thing that's sort of playing a larger part. And then how does that sort of affect what you do now?
Yeah, I think it's almost trite to say it, but digital is everything for me. And the reason I say that is I got into print reporting to become a print reporter. Mm-hmm. And the business was changing then. Certainly there was a digital component and things were very much in flux by the late 90s when I first got into the business. But you could still be a print reporter.
Right.
And that's it. You could still be a TV reporter today. I didn't, though, go into ABC News saying I want to become a television reporter. I want to become a broadcast journalist. I don't think of myself that way. I think of myself – the phrase that I've used is platform agnostic. I don't care, literally don't care how you consume your news. I want to get it to you however that way is. And if that is – purely online or mobile, digital, if that is just through the television airwaves or the radio airwaves, if that's just print, I want to find a way to get you there. And if that's going to just beam something directly into your head, I want to be part of that technology. So the technology has always been secondary to me, and that's what digital allows. And it's also opened a lot of doors for people, I think myself included, who wouldn't have been traditionally thought of as a TV reporter. And I don't think I would have been able to make the transition from print to TV just on my considerable good looks or my, my wonderful camera presence. I didn't have any sense of what that was, and that wasn't what I was going for either. I think at that time it was the idea of having someone that could live in the digital space that would understand what the digital technologies were and how they change and how you have to change to adapt to them that I think made me attractive to them and continues to keep me employed by ABC News.
So do you think there's been, as far as like management or production, that the perception has changed of the newscaster, the broadcaster, that, it doesn't matter if the person is primarily a digital reporter, if they've got something important or interesting to say, that we're going to want to have them on?
Yeah, we're getting there. I mean, look, I think there's TV is still TV, and what we do at ABC News, the most important thing is still the thing that reaches the most viewers. But all that said, I mean, we've got other things. You mentioned Topline, which is our webcast that we do in partnership with Yahoo News. The numbers that we get of people watching this little 5-6 minute segment is will rival and beat daytime cable often. I mean, we're getting more viewers than CNN would at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on these little things we put together. So that's another way to reach. But I think the business is changing, the organization is changing along these lines, and I think the smartest journalists now, whether they're 22, 42, or 62, are thinking along these lines and trying to figure out how they can craft a full persona that is not just the person that you see in front of the building at 6:30 with a good stand-up, or not just the person that has the byline on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, that there has to be a full digital integration around everything that you do, and that your personal brand as a reporter depends on reaching people in lots of different ways. The only exception that I think continues to that is kind of the real big name anchors. Mm-hmm. Diane Sawyer does a lot on Twitter and a lot on Facebook, but she would exist as Diane Sawyer without that. But I think just about anyone short of the anchors of the major broadcasts needs to engage, needs to find other ways to be meeting the viewer, meeting the reader wherever they want to be met.
Well, and I can think of a couple of local TV anchors who, are very much about, communicating and reaching their audience. And are doing stuff on Twitter all the time. Now, we were talking before we started recording about Twitter and about what the role it plays in what you do. Could you sort of elaborate on that?
There has been You know, when I'm going to date myself a little bit this, but my first job at a newspaper, we had email, of course.
I remember Linotype. So
okay, so we had email, but there was only one computer in the newsroom that you could get your email on. Everyone had to line up and check their email.
No.
Honestly, this is 1998 in Dallas, and you went check like once or twice a day. You went over there,
and they did like eo.
No, it was better. There was better connection than that. I'm not that old, but close. So, but an email obviously has changed the way that we work as reporters, as have cell phones and text messaging and all that. I had a pager, and had to pull over to the side of the road and use a payphone when I first when I first started in Dallas. But
oh my god.
That's exactly. But but Twitter has changed the way that I do my job even a more profound way, I think, than that. And I don't put Facebook in the same category, at least for me personally, but for other people it is. Twitter is an absolutely essential part of my everyday existence, professionally and personally. It is my news aggregator. It is the most efficient way that I can have to make sure that I'm seeing the stories that I need to see. I can just pull up TweetDeck and see the people I follow. I'm not going to miss anything. I'm going to see the news as it breaks. I'm going to see the important stories, even in very small local places. It's all there for me. It's a way for me to engage with sources. There are multiple members of Congress that I have direct message relationships with, and I don't mean in the Anthony Weiner sense of relationships at all. I mean, people that I normally wouldn't be able. I'd have to penetrate several layers of spokespeople to even be able to make contact with Senator so and so, who I can actually just send a direct message to and hear directly from the source back and get confirmation on something or a phone call back on something. So there's that. Also, just in terms of the insider audience, everyone that operates in my sphere of politics and media in Washington is on Twitter. So connecting with each other, communicating with each other, it's helped just build, I think, my personal exposure, my personal brand, mm-hmm. the fact that I know the people that are out there that I'm talking to. I can't even remember how I did my job without it. And 4 years ago, I didn't have it. 5 years ago, I didn't have it. So it's remarkable how fast it's happened. But that to me is an example of, needing to embrace a new piece of communications as it develops. I mean, we've gone, the news organization has been moving in digital directions for a long time. But now with Twitter, we put a hashtag up at the bottom of every ABC News broadcast, no matter what, this week or Nightline or GMA and World News. It's there. It's part of what we do. It's part of how we communicate. And again, I just can't imagine going backwards and being told they can't use this thing anymore.
I still find it amazing that there are people who are resistant still to Twitter. That I occasionally run is, oh, well, that's just, the people posting things about their lunch and everything. It's ridiculous.
I try not to post about lunch.
I listen, full disclosure, I don't watch a lot of television news, but I listen to all the political talk shows on C-SPAN. And have for years.
Mm-hmm.
And this week is absolutely my favorite one. I think it's the best one for a lot of different reasons. I have a couple of questions about it. One is, I want to know how you guys assemble your panel, because I think it's the best panel.
In terms of the panel, we put a lot of thought into who we put in there. And, one thing you look for is diversity in every sense in ideological, in race and ethnicity and background as well, male and female and all that. You want to make sure you're not just talking to people that are going to present one point of view. And one thing we think about is kind of people who are good foils for each other. If there's a very good Republican member of Congress that we want to have on, is there a good Democratic member of Congress that we want to pair that person with? The kind of classic is James Carville and Mary Madeline. I mean, they're a natural. They've had this, that shtick growing on for a long time. You know what you're going to get with them. We also sprinkle in our own people as part of that. I mean, George Will has been part of the program for a long time. People like Cokie Roberts and Sam Donaldson are just institutions in Washington, and you're going to get really strong material from them, involving our own reporters. If George Stephanopoulos is anchoring, you're as likely to see John Carl, who's our White House correspondent, and fills in for him sometimes as part of that. But basically, you just want to get the most interesting discussion you can get. And I'm glad to hear that you like it on radio as well, because
to me,
you can tell a lot about television by just listening to it. And the best discussions should be transferable to radio, whether or not you get the full effect of George Will without seeing him. You're getting a sense of who these people are and what they're coming from. So, we also, another piece that we try to mix it is people that with insider experience or current insiders. We like having sitting office holders as part of the roundtable, people that are candidates for office who are high profile as part of that. People have written interesting things and bring an interesting perspective, but it is a huge puzzle and challenge every week to find the right four or five people for the roundtable, which is among the most popular parts of the show. It's surprising to me in the sense that every cable show does that every hour of the day in some way, you know, debating the fact that people are still willing to on Sunday mornings interested in what, you know, a collection of four or five people have to say about the issues of the week. But it has a remarkable persistence, and I think it is because of the good casting and the good conversation. You know, obviously the topics are important too, and just choosing what you want to talk about. All of that is they think about it very, very carefully. George thinks about it carefully.
It used to bother me a long time ago. We'll say that George Stephanopoulos, like, I kind of resented him a little bit because he didn't start out as a journalist, and yet he's very, very good at his job.
Yeah.
So I was kind of wanting to talk to you about, like, what you think of people who are coming out of the political realm who become journalists. I mean, I think he's probably the best example. I think he's the most successful example. Well,
for the record, George doesn't bother me at all. I love him. But, and I mean that. I adore the man. But more broadly, actually what he did was probably a little bit ahead of its time. Like, it's become much more common practice now to see people moving between the spheres of politics and political communication. Maybe not at the level that he did, where he, you know, went full in and is now an anchor at ABC. But the idea that, you know, that I mean, we just saw CNN hire Kevin Madden and Stephanie Cutter and Newt Gingrich, by the way. I mean, Stephanie and Kevin are good friends of mine, and I've, you know, covered them when they worked at campaigns for many, many years. And, you know, now they're going to be pundits, essentially, right? You know, so you see more of that. You know, people have talked about Joe Scarborough running for office, Chris Matthews running for office. I mean, you know, Tim Russert came out of that same tradition as an aide on Capitol Hill, just like George Stephanopoulos got his start. So it's happening more. You know, when George did it in the late 90s, you know, he had to transition into it. He started really more the pundit role, mm-hmm. And became more of a reporter. But, you know, I see firsthand that same fire that he brought to politics, brought to bear on journalism, and it's really productive. And to understand it at that level, I've often thought, you know, I wish I had done a stint on the Hill before I got into journalism. Like, if I could chart a career path, things have worked out great for me. I have no complaints. But if I could have said, you know, at age 21, instead of going and covering cops for the Dallas Morning News, if I had gone and, you know, worked on the Hill as a junior press aide or something, right, you know, it may have helped my development, my understanding even to this day of how stories are covered. So there's a lot less of a stigma attached to that now, although it's not, for you know, it's not easy transition for anyone to go from that world, right, to this one.
I was going
to
say, I mean, they're hiring people now who are experts, not necessarily experts in television or experts in reporting, print. They're experts in their field and what they're talking about.
Yeah,
and that's changed.
And that's actually a huge lesson that I try to impart on young journalists all the time, is that you're better off with a specialty of some sort. You know, to be the person on, you know, healthcare financing right now would be actually really interesting. And that will make you a hireable commodity if you know you're good at it. I mean, GAs, there's nothing wrong with being a general assignment reporter. I've been it, you know, and there's something about just going out and doing whatever. But, like, the idea that you can drill down in something and understand it is going to make you hireable forever, and makes you much more marketable, you know. And I think the idea of just going for jobs that put you in a better position to hone in on a specialty is just, to me, a really compelling way to develop a career.
A word you were throwing around a couple of times was brand.
Yeah.
How important is it to develop the brand? Even, you know, maybe you don't have to be a news anchor brand, but, you know, you as a journalist or as a, you know, you as a journalist or broadcaster coming forward, to develop who you are.
I think it's more important than ever. I think, you know, we all have employers, or most of us. I mean, you could be a freelancer and a freelance brand, but most of us do have employers. But I feel like that part of the job matters less than it ever did, or certainly that it has in my memory. I feel like in a previous generation, if you were the White House correspondent for the New York Times or ABC News, that was itself enough to you know, that was your ticket already to the big dance. Now I think, you know, there are people with much less esteemed titles who are more influential in that sphere. And, you know, I think if you are White House correspondent for the New York Times, you have to think about what that brand really is and where you extend it to, and what does it mean for you as a fully formed journalist. And what appears in the pages of the New York Times or on the airwaves of ABC News is just a slice of it. And so, not to say that your employer is not important. We work for these big companies that pay us for a reason to produce for them. But I think the most successful journalists, in a generation going forward, are going to be those who have a way to marry the professional brand and that personal brand in a productive way.
And I think thanks to things like Twitter and Facebook, where you're actually building your identity and then linking that identity to what your career is and what your specialty is, I think that sort of naturally sort of grows that.
It's easier to do than ever because of that. I mean, because you can, you know, I don't need to, you know, to go through any hoops to just post something right now on Twitter, and that's part of who I am. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what that brand is. And, you know, that the number of people who are following you on Twitter, that may just be a slice of the total number of people that are reading your stories or seeing you on TV or online, but it's an important slice, and it kind of keeps that conversation going constantly.
Now, the other question I want to ask you is about elections. You said you came to D.C. to cover the Bush campaign?
Yeah, the Bush campaign, 2004.
Things have changed quite a lot in the last few elections. What's your perception of that?
I had it easy. I mean, I think that 2004 campaign was probably the last one where reporters can go out there and expect to have a good time. not to say I wasn't working very hard, because I was, but, you know, again, in the category of dating myself, I went out in the campaign and I wrote a story a day. Whatever campaign stop would happen as close to my deadline, which is around 6 or 7 o'clock as possible, I would hit send on a final story, and it would, you know, that was dial up modems in a lot of these campaign stops at the time, but, you know, sometimes it was Wi-Fi, sometimes not, but then I'd send it and I'd be done. And unless, you know, someone tripped on the podium, you know, I could enjoy the last stop of the night and have a drink on the plane at 11 o'clock at night as we're flying. I feel bad for the reporters who are doing it now, because you have to be tweeting constantly and blogging and updating. And, you know, there's always another deadline, and there's no such thing as just being done for the day. Politics is moving so fast and so much faster than it did. 2008 was intense. 2012 was crazy intense. It scares me to think about what 2016 is going to be like. another phrase that I use a lot is politics being conducted faster than the speed of thought. And I think we are there. Unfortunately, fortunately, whatever you want to say, we're there. And I don't know of a way back. I don't know how you put the genie back in, because we are. Every demand is to make it faster, to make the bite sizes even smaller, and to speed up the cycle. So it's just a lot harder, just physically demanding to be a reporter than it was two election cycles ago.
Are we getting better journalism from that? Are we getting better government from that?
I don't know. I don't think it's related to the quality of the journalism necessarily. I think there's still a lot of good journalism that's being done as part of this. Some of them are good tweets, honestly. You know, I don't think it's making us, you know, it's by itself making worse journalism. I would say that it's more of a demand on reporters' time. So the extent that, you know, people that would be working on really, really exciting profiles or really good television pieces, if they're spending their time, you know, tweeting nothingness instead, then yes, it's hurting the end work product. But I'm also not among those who would just say, like, you know, be done with all this stuff and be, you know, say we're over tweeting because we could get better stuff somewhere else. Like there was actually productive stuff that's happening in the Twitter conversation, in blogs, and some of the creative things that are being done. Whether we're getting better government, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm personally distressed by the dysfunction that surrounds Washington, and I don't know that the type of media we have covering it is changing it that much. I don't think that the way that things are being covered right now is making for better governance by itself. I don't know that it's always making for worse. I think there's a lot of complicated reasons for that. And I think the speeding up of the news cycle and the 24-hour news cycle doesn't even describe it. I mean, the news cycles last seconds, and it's every second of the day is another news cycle in a sense. I don't even know what I'm missing, because I haven't checked my Twitter feed, and, you know, since this podcast started, you know, there's something else that's happening out there. Yeah, I mean, there's something else that's happening out there, literally. You know, I still have this strange sensation. The only time I'm really disconnected, other than sleeping, which, you know, that can be interrupted by a lot of things, including your phone ring or your kid crying, is when you're on a plane. When I'm on a plane now, and the deluge of emails that I've missed, and when I come in and the numbers start popping up on the BlackBerry, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 450, 500 emails that I then have to wade through and see what I missed, and in all that time, how much useful information or necessary information, not much, not much happened.
Tell us about, obviously you're following politicians and people in the know on Twitter. Putting you on the spot, who would be some good people to follow as far as like content?
You want politicians or political journalists or what?
Yeah, I know Chuck Grassley's good because he's funny.
Yeah, I mean, look, Chuck Grassley's great because he's honest and he's doing it himself. I mean, those are always the best. And, you know, you want people who are going to be themselves. If they're just linking to press releases,
yeah,
you know, I can get that. Lots of other places. Claire McCaskill was one of the early ones who was doing it really well. She kept people updated on her diet and, you know, lots of her travels. And I always found that to be entertaining. There's some House members who've gotten in trouble, not just Anthony Weiner, in terms of what they've posted, because they can be a little too honest and then they have to go delete it. I'm thinking about like Congressman Cohen, who, you know, revealed himself to have had a daughter from years ago based on tweets that they send out. So I guess those are interesting and good to follow. You know, to me, Twitter works for engagement, and if it's just people sending links to the stories they wrote or the appearances they're on, or, hey, check me out, you know, later tonight I'm going to be on Fox, like, that's just not that interesting, you know. But the real people that get it, and unfortunately there are fewer as time goes by, because if I was working for a politician, I would take Twitter off his or her cell phone really fast, because there's really very few good things that can happen out of it. Cory Booker, I should mention, Cory Booker is probably made the best and most interesting use of Twitter there is, because, you know, if you don't follow him on Twitter, well, if you live in Newark, you have to follow him on Twitter, but he literally will respond to reports of potholes and, you know, and here's my cell phone, call me with more details on that problem you had with, you know, billing at the hospital or something. That to me is like, you know, he's a mayor of a city, and he's serving the people, and that's what it should be. That's perfect. Most politicians don't think like that. Most don't.
So Twitter does. I mean, you said you can't imagine doing your job without it, but it does drive content. Have you? I mean, broken things on Twitter?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, when Sarah Palin was going to announce that she wasn't running for president in the last cycle, we had a heads up of seconds that it was going to happen. Literally, she was going to announce it in a radio interview, and we knew seconds before it was going to happen. And that was like, you know,
get those thumbs moving.
Yeah, shaking as I'm typing to try to type it as fast as I could, because in that nanosecond, now, like, those are not the kind of scoops that careers are made on. Like, you know, that I'm not suggesting that you're breaking Watergate on Twitter by saying Sarah Palin is not going to run 10 seconds before the rest of the universe. But there is, you know, there's an opportunity there. And I think a realization of from organizations like ABC that, you know, the idea of holding this news till 6:30 doesn't work anymore. That you know, there's some things you can do, like truly exciting, big investigative exclusives, things like that. But like the basic news cycle will not wait for their next broadcast or their next morning's paper. We have to be out there and in the news cycle constantly to keep that in the mix constantly.
Well, give us a little insight then on the process of something that breaks on Twitter. What does that do in the newsroom that you're at?
Well, the first thing will be people will start forwarding around. If it's something in my world, did we know this? Can we match this? Do we think it's true? Those kind of questions get asked really, really quickly. You know, sometimes, you know, to use the current events example of the plane crash in San Francisco, a lot of what was coming out on Twitter, a lot is wrong, as always. A lot of it, though, was photos and videos and things that we needed to get our lawyers on to clear and to ask people the rights to broadcast various images that were coming out. But it's an early warning system to get us asking the questions in the right direction, to know who we're calling or where we're going to be asking to find out more about something. There's a lot of truly awful things that people put out there that ends up being, you know, maliciously or not, just wrong. And, you know, we have to be very careful in terms of what we do as a news organization. We've got pretty strict guidelines about, you know, when we're allowed to report something on Twitter or anywhere else. And, you know, we'll get in trouble with the higher ups if we jump the gun on those sort of things. And they're important. I mean, you know, whether that's, you know, someone dying and, you know, that everyone's tweeting memories of that person. And, you know, we want to make sure they're actually dead before we do that, because there's a lot of rumors out there. You don't want to fondly remember someone, you know, too often. So, you know, there's a piece that's around that. And then there's, you know, just as again, this early warning sign, like we knew about the San Francisco thing, you know, before most of the public did, because we have people that are monitoring. We have a social media desk at ABC News that is, you know, spending basically 24/7 monitoring tweets and seeing what's out there and seeing what, you know, what the next big story is going to be. I liken it to, I mean, when I was a cops reporter at the Dallas Morning News, I used to make a round of cops calls. I had 75 local police agencies that I would call twice a day. Anything going on? Thanks. Anything going on? How things, you know, how are things in Coppell this morning? How are things in Farmers Branch? Anything going on? And I would just call one by one by one and just, you know, just a sense of what's happening. Maybe that's still happening at places. I kind of doubt it. I feel like you could, you know, follow enough Twitter feeds that you'd know if something big is happening in any of those places without having to make a phone call. So that just as a, you know, scanner traffic of 2013.
Now, somebody who sees you on TV as a political expert, a political analyst, a broadcaster, who wants to go figure out what that track is to get to that job, what would you recommend?
I think go deep in a world that you want to cover. You know, find a way to be covering politics at a state or a local level, maybe the national level. If you want to go deep into the to work for the Hill or Roll Call or Politico or something, but you know, learn a particular subject area and use that as your launching point. I mean, I was fortunate. I worked at the Dallas Morning News. I didn't do much politics in Dallas, but I happened to be there when George W. Bush became a national figure and, you know, ran for president. And then I was in Boston, you know, covering John Kerry in the run-up to 2004, and Mitt Romney, you know, emanated from the state as well. So I knew there was a little bit of specialty knowledge that I could bring to a national story pretty early on in my career. And I think, you know, the political journalists that I've known have been there for hot stories. They, you know, they happened to be the reporter at the State House in Little Rock when Bill Clinton, you know, became a national figure. There's something to be said for just learning something, having an area of specialty, and using that to kind of develop your Rolodex, develop your contacts, develop your sources, and to expand beyond that. But using something strong as a home base, then to come in and say, you know, I'm going to be, you know, covering the 2016 elections, like, it's really hard. I mean, there's a lot of candidates, and, you know, there's a lot of potential news to be broken, but there's a lot of roadblocks in that. And I wouldn't recommend that any, you know, unless you're just like there are true dynamos in this world that, you know, could do it at 22. I wasn't one of them. I mean, I feel like you still need some years in the political minors to get ready for the big league pitching.
And reporting minors.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And yep. Doing, you know, like covering cops in Dallas, I mean, it was never going to be my long-term career goal, but, you know, it teaches you to, you know, learn any story quickly, be very detail-oriented, and being able to ask uncomfortable questions of people in authority, like cops and prosecutors, mm-hmm. and also grieving families, and to knock on a door. And I still think that's the hardest thing I've ever had to do in journalism is mm-hmm. yeah. to have to knock on the door of someone whose loved one just died and to ask for a photo on the way out the door. I mean, that's, you know, after that, it's easy to ask a politician, you know, why they flip-flopped on something.
Right. Right. And those are important skills to learn and important stories to do as well. You know, we kind of touched a little bit on the presidential election thing and just looking at the 2012 and sort of the role that social media played on that. Do you think, you know, how important a role is that going to play in upcoming elections? Do you think that we're going to see less of an impact of mainstream media and newspapers and it's going to be more of that? Or you think it's that what had happened with the Obama campaign was sort of overblown and that's not going to be so much of a factor?
I think it'll be a factor in the same way that I talked about myself as platform agnostic. I think campaigns are too. I mean, they want to reach people as they want to be reached, as they're reachable. And it doesn't matter what that is. And it used to be that direct mail and phone calls and TV were the only ways to do it. And now there are other ways. Now, I'll also tell you firsthand, talking to campaigns, by far the most effective way of disseminating a message remains television advertising. Mm. It is just the one kind of foolproof way that you know you can get in the mix. And they would love it because it's expensive. They'd love to find another way to do it. It's, you know, they'd love to spend less money and get people on Twitter instead. It doesn't work the same way. You know, there is some data out there that suggests that the person-to-person contacts can be more valuable on balance, but they're harder to make. And it's not, you know, I don't think we're ready for the full, you know, a social media alone election. Far from it. The vast majority of money spent in 2012 was still on big television ads. It will be in 2016. It will be in 2020. You know, there will be a time, you know, maybe in my career, maybe not, where that's not the main way to reach mm-hmm. people, but it is for the foreseeable future. You know, there will be more of a role, people playing around with some things in social media, but I also think that, you know, that no one's going to really take the plunge and be done with traditional media because that's still the way to reach large numbers of people.
As far as political reporting goes, do you feel like we're going in the right direction or do you feel like you're kind of, things are stalling out or are you optimistic?
I define the right direction in maybe a different way than a lot of people do. I define the right direction in terms of promoting participation, because I think that fundamentally what we do as political reporters, what I do as a political reporter, is to inform the public about their elected officials and about the candidates for office. And people need to take that information and then exercise their own judgment, and they vote, and they exercise their rights in a democracy. I feel strongly about voting. I vote every time. I don't tell anyone, even my mom, who I'm voting for, but I vote every time I can, you know, because I feel like personally I wouldn't be true to my own mission if I didn't vote at the end of the day, because I feel like that is, you know, that's promoting it. Now, so you look at polls and people hate politicians and they hate political journalists and all that.
They hate all journalists.
They hate all journalists. Yeah. So like in any of those metrics, you know, you shouldn't be particularly optimistic about the direction of political journalism if you hate politics and politicians and journalists and everything like that. But, you know, we are seeing participation, you know, after a long downward trend begin to pick up. The 2008 campaign, even more than 2012, but, you know, it's held relatively steady. So to the extent that people are caring about this stuff and passionate about it, even if they may hate something in particular you write or report, that leaves me relatively optimistic. The other thing I'm optimistic about, I should say, for this audience is the prospects for journalists and political journalists included. There are just so many opportunities out there that weren't out there 15 years ago when I got in the business, and certainly weren't there 25 or 35 years ago. People that are able to make their own stand and their own mark on things very quickly. And, you know, don't have to spend as much time toiling away, have less of a risk of getting lost in a place that you're not happy as a reporter. There's just for people that have the drive, the ambition, the smarts, the technological know-how, like there's a lot of paths out there that you get to chart for yourself.
Well, this has been very interesting.
Yes.
And great. Tell us where people can find your work on social media.
Well, at Rick Klein, RickKlein, pretty easy to find on Twitter, Facebook, you know, search me, Rick Klein and ABC. ABCnews.com/politics is the clearinghouse for all of the digital content that we have, and we try to feed as much of it as possible through The Note and The Note blog, through web stories, through the video that we put up there, through our partnership with Yahoo on my show Top Line. So we try to be as full service as possible around those things. But start with Twitter, because that's usually the one place to get everything.
Content is king.
Indeed.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Rick. This has been great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com.
Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @alljournalism.